It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben. As always, we're joined by our producer, Noel the Lion Brown.
The Lion. Okay.
Not bad.
That's not bad. Not bad. I will stick with that for now and see if anything comes up along the way. How about Peppermill?
That's great. Peppermill Brown.
I don't know, the two names for the nickname. I don't know if that works or not. I guess so. Maybe like when you call somebody like Tin Cup or something like that, or a Tin Can or Pork Chop or something like that.
You know, this is interesting because I was reading about an arrest, a news story about an arrest of several Devil's Disciples gang members, Fight Club members, who had a couple of different nicknames.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the guys who was sort of the national warlord for the organization, his nickname or his club name was Gun Control.
Gun Control.
Which I get it because he's in charge of that.
Well, I guess so. Yeah. Kind of strange, huh?
It just doesn't really roll off the tongue.
No, it's not catchy like Pork Chop or something like that.
Right.
Or a Peppermill.
Yeah. Yeah. This, I mean, far be it for me to criticize because I totally get the function of the name, but it was just weird to me because we always play around with nicknames at the beginning to read this. And I've been, since our earlier podcast on Sturgis, I've been reading a lot more. I get in these kicks, Scott, where I start reading about outlaw biker culture, you know, the 1% stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating. I think that a lot of people have probably a wrong idea of it. And I certainly, being on the outside of it, I can read some great reports or some interviews or statements by former and current members, but it's the difference between intellectually knowing a thing and experientially knowing it.
Yeah. I don't know if I've ever known anybody personally who's been involved in a gang like that, or especially an outlaw gang or a true 1%er. I've known somebody that I think in the past maybe had, he was older at this point and just wasn't part of that lifestyle anymore.
Maybe he just had affiliations.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, he was back, in the days when I'd do landscaping or something, the guy would come in and, he had, the jacket on with the patches and things, but I don't think he was active at that time. I don't think he was an active member.
Mm-hmm.
So interesting character. And, I'm sure he had a ton of stories to tell. I just didn't really probe that deep into what was going on there.
Right.
Well, maybe for good reason. I don't know. Maybe he wouldn't even have opened up about it. You never know.
You never know. And
kind of secretive about that stuff.
And also, if this is, I'm going to go out on a limb and say this was a work friend.
Yes.
So you don't know how deeply you should delve into the lives of your colleagues.
That's another good point. Yeah. Office politics, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
Even if your office is, out in the forest somewhere. I was landscaping.
I don't know the last names of half the people we work with. Or the first names for that matter. I've just been winging it.
I just kind of, hey,
for
how are you doing
for the past 7 years.
Yeah, really.
Yep. So how
it's a small office too.
How is your child? So no, I'm kidding. But speaking of fantastic stories, we have something that we're excited to bring to you guys today, because every so often we will do something that's a little bit more work, more time intensive.
Oh, it sure is.
But we will find a legendary individual or institution or even just type of car, and we will tell that car story. We're going to follow that car. Oh, that's a pretty good title for something later.
That's not bad. Yeah, I like that.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
Today, we are going to take a closer look at the past, present, and future of Peugeot.
Yeah, that's right. And this is going to take some twists and turns along the way, just like you would expect. Nothing quite like the U-Haul family history or anything like that, or, what was the other
Mickey
one?
Thompson.
Shakespeare, I think, was the Shakespeare family.
Nothing
like that. But this has got other twists and turns, but, let's just start off with this, Ben. Peugeot, and we'll get into some other stuff, and we'll tell you what's going to happen later. Later on, we've got some other kind of little interesting tidbits to, you know, current news and things like that we can bring up, but, the Peugeot story doesn't start with automobiles, as most people would expect.
No, it starts way, way further back. Actually, I think between us, I've got some stuff that goes super far back.
Okay, how far back?
We're talking late 1700s.
Wow, okay. That's a little bit earlier than I had. So what have you got?
Okay, so what we've got here is that originally the Peugeot family, from what we believe, came from Switzerland. And you can see their name on various parish registers, and they were elected mayors there for successive generations. So this has been a successful family line for some time. I think really what we need to start with as far as an individual would be Jean-Pierre Peugeot, right? Jean-Pierre?
Yeah, Jean-Pierre, and he was born in 1734. So I do have the birth date of him, but really what we're talking about is the mill that he owned eventually, right? Because he tried his hand at a bunch of different types of businesses, settled on this grain mill eventually, you know, probably where was it? Yeah, it was along the stream, because I mean it's got the water wheel and all that along with it. But he starts this mill it's actually successful, but he did other things like, you know, he ran a dye works for a while,
tanning,
weaving business I think for a while as well. But this grain mill was what really kind of took off for him as a success. And, of course, he has a family. He's got a couple of sons, Jean-Pierre II and Jean-Frédéric Peugeot, of course.
Right. Yeah. And they are the ones who transformed the grain mill. They found Peugeot Frère, right? And I apologize for my French, of course. Should have said that earlier. But that's the Peugeot brothers.
Excuse my French.
Yes. Oh, we never get to say, oh, man, missed opportunity.
I know. But it'd be a perfect spot for it, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it? Yeah.
Okay.
Well, so they transformed their father's mill into a steel foundry.
Yes. And not just making what you would expect, not just like sheet steel or, you know, nuts and bolts and screws and things, but some interesting things came out of there. They made... let's see, I'm just going to pick some of the metal stuff here before we talk about the ones that I find maybe the most interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
they made springs for watchmaking. They made, saws. They made umbrella frames and even steel strips for dressmaking, because they had those giant, I think it was called crinoline. Is that right? The big dresses that they had to, have a certain shape. And the shape was held in place by these metal strips. And
like so these ribbing things almost.
Yeah, exactly. The ribbing things. And these guys were making the metal strips that were fitting into the dresses. So very industrious, very smart on their part. But that wasn't their big thing.
No. Well, just for some background, just to show how quickly they rose, they made the transformation to metalworking in 1810, but they had a patent in 1819 for steel cold rolling, which allowed them to expand into these various different industries. So what's the bigger one?
The bigger one is coffee mills. They made coffee mills and pepper and salt grinders. And it's exactly what it sounds like. I mean, it's just a big, you know, a box that you put on the table and grind up coffee. Everybody can picture that with a big crank on it, handle.
Right.
And a pepper mill is in the ones that they still bring to your table, you know, at the restaurants today and grind pepper onto your food. Salt mills, because they had coarse salt as well. And that is something, and I'm not giving anything away here, but if you go to one of the, the boutique type stores in Paris or in Berlin, I think right now. There's a Peugeot owned, like these mega showroom type areas, like, boutiques almost.
Mm-hmm.
Flagship stores. You can buy Peugeot branded salt and pepper mills still. And they've got a ton of them. I've seen photos of, you know, the variety. It's enormous, but that's part of this history that goes all the way back to about 1810. When they were founded as what, like a metal shop, the coffee mill factory?
Right.
I don't know what you'd call it, really. I guess metalworks, maybe.
Yeah.
But this is really the Peugeot that gave birth to the Peugeot that we know today.
So if we count it as one thing, what we're talking about is a company that has existed for 205 years.
Yes, that's right. They celebrated their bicentennial in 2010, and they had like a whole logo redesign and everything, which we'll talk about as well.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, I kind of hinted that we're going to talk about some different things, but we're going to talk about bicycles. We're going to talk about scooters, mm-hmm. motorcycles. We're going to talk about racing history. We're going to talk about
a certain steam tricycle, perhaps.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, how they name their cars, because they all have a very distinctive number pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very proud of that, as I found out as I'm reading this article. And let's see, what else we can talk about?
We can talk about some of their racing accolades.
Yeah, we can do that. Maybe a little bit about gray market cars, maybe,
mm-hmm.
just touch on that.
Yep.
And, well, let's see. How about the Warriors? We'll talk about those as well.
Right.
Maybe the French car reputation. Should we talk about that
a little bit?
Yeah,
in general,
too?
That's a great one. And then we can also just, while we're – I feel like we're in a supermarket sweep of facts right now.
Yeah.
You know what? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Supermarket sweep was this thing, for anyone who's somehow unfamiliar, where I was pretty young when I saw this – wherein contestants would get a certain amount of time and a shopping cart and be let loose in an empty grocery store.
Well, a full grocery store, but no people.
Right. A grocery store without people, but full of products.
Yes.
And their goal would be to get the most expensive cumulative amount of stuff.
Yeah.
And so now I feel like we're in that sweep. We've got limited time, Scott, and we're grabbing the most interesting or valuable facts.
Yeah, so I think you'd head to the meat and wine aisles.
Yeah, that
the
would
most
make
valuable
sense.
Things.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I wonder what the strategy was in that. I mean,
filet all day.
And you know, I think just another little sidebar thing here, but wasn't that sometimes often awarded as a prize decades ago? It seems like supermarkets, you know, if you were the 1 millionth visitor, or if they had a sweepstakes competition where your name was drawn from the hat or whatever.
Oh man,
you would have, you know, somebody would follow you with extra carts even, and you'd had a certain amount of time, 5 minutes, whatever, to get as much product into your carts as possible for your family. It was like a shopping spree, really.
That's a cool idea.
I
haven't heard that.
I swear I've seen that at a toy store too for kids, you know, like FAO Schwartz or something like that did that. Or maybe it's Toys R Us or one of those.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot about these like shopping spree type packages trophies, but awards.
Yeah, these sweepstakes and contests. You know, a lot of companies don't do that anymore.
No.
Peugeot would certainly not let you run into one of their dealerships, which we should also mention.
Oh, probably.
On a sweep.
Yeah, probably not. I wouldn't think so. They're kind of a, they border on, they've got luxury, you know, items, luxury vehicles.
I believe so, yeah.
But they're kind of a middle of the road. They're not exactly the lowest end economy cars. They're not exactly the top end luxury cars. They're somewhere right in the middle. That's where they fit.
Well, this is interesting too. This is something we should talk about maybe toward the end, because for a lot of folks in the U.S., Peugeots have this reputation of rarity and high-end luxury just because they are so rarely seen.
I am glad you mentioned that, Ben, because we were just talking about this off air that, I can probably count the number of Peugeot automobiles that I've seen and kind of registered in my head as being a Peugeot here in the United States on both hands or
right.
less, you know, probably less.
I can count them on one hand and still have four fingers left over.
Exactly right. And, you know, there's a good reason for that. I mean, anybody here in the North American market will understand that Peugeot has been out of the game here in our market, since about 1991, I believe.
Yeah, since the early 90s.
Yeah, so it's been a long time. We're talking 25 years, 24 years at this point.
Yeah, and even before then, they weren't particularly common.
No, they really weren't. They were rare. And, you know, at that time, of course, you know, where I was living, I was in Detroit, that area. That would not have been a popular choice, I would think. And that's probably the only place I really saw any at that time, because I was, you know, right around when I was, you know, driving age and that type of thing, you know, kind of noticing what's on the road. But you said you've maybe seen one, and it was at a car show, right?
Yeah, when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know that other people in the rest of the world are saying, are you kidding me? I can look out my window right now and see 20 of them.
Right. I'm in traffic. I'm stuck behind this stupid Peugeot right now.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I know that, you know, well, you and I have both traveled here and there, and you've we spent some time in Guatemala. You probably saw some down there.
Peugeot is a popular model in other places.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been to Spain. I've seen them there. You know, Europe has them all over the place. So
Peugeots are in Iran, man.
Yeah, well, they're everywhere. They're pretty much everywhere except here, unless you get something or unless you see something that's from, you know, pre-1990
or maybe gray market.
Okay. That's the tricky part about this gray market thing, though. And I said we would mention this, is that, you know, right now in the U.S., we're on a 25-year embargo, right? Mm-hmm. So if you go back to 1990, that's when you can't officially – or that's when you can officially begin importing cars, is, you know, anything that's older than that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're at the spot right now. It's like that sweet spot where you could get a gray market car, I guess, in 1990, but you can still buy a 1991 model here in the United States. So next year, it will become something that is a little more exclusive, I suppose, you know, something that wasn't available here.
That's true.
But that won't happen until 2016. So kind of an interesting point in history, I guess, for us with the Peugeot brand. And then there's a little bit of news on that later, too.
Yeah, so stay tuned for that before you run out, catch the flight to one of the dealerships and make the purchase and try to get it back here. So, okay, let's see. We were talking about the history. We talked about the brothers, and we talked about the bicentennial that happened recently, 205 years old.
But Ben, we're still in the 1800s, early 1800s.
We're still in pre-car world because we mentioned that they made bicycles, right? One thing that's really neat about this is that when you are an industrial concern and you are creating multiple pieces of consumer goods or multiple types of consumer goods, the weird thing is, I always think about the Taco Bell formula, which I think we've mentioned on air before.
I don't know if we have. What's the Taco Bell formula?
I'm sure that there is a MBA somewhere who has an actual proposition or understanding of this or this principle, but here's how I discovered it. I was at a Taco Bell one day because my life was just in a weird place and I was eating pretty unhealthy.
Hey, you don't have to come clean to me. I love Taco Bell.
I do too, man. I do too. But
this is not a commercial, by the way.
This is not a commercial.
No, no.
They're not paying us to say that. What could they do? Because Taco Bell is one of the only places in town where you can be full for $3.
And it's a good point.
Anyhow, I was looking at the menu and I thought, I want to order something different. And there's, you know, this panoply of things you can choose. And then I realized Taco Bell is taking the same handful of ingredients and pretending that those are 30 different things. And that's so smart from a business perspective, right? And this is what Peugeot is doing at the same time, because the same processes used to make that boning for the corset is used to make the spokes for bicycles, right?
Yeah, very clever.
Yeah, very clever and fascinating too, because what we'll see, spoiler alert, ladies and gentlemen, when we go into the era of the automobile, is that those same spokes are turning up.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? How the same things from old, from the olden times, I guess, are appearing in modern day, but refined. You know, of course, they're perfected along the way.
And they're adapted. They're specialized, modified.
Yeah, exactly. So these things are going to come up again, and you're going to say, "Man, they've been doing that a long, long time." It's a very smart move on their part. And let's jump back into the 1800s, and we're let's say right around 1830. How about that?
Okay. Yeah,
all right. Perfect. So right around 1830, they start making bicycles.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that they continued until very, very recently. I think they just recently stopped bicycle production under the Peugeot brand name. Mm-hmm. The bicycle company, of course, they split ways, I believe, in, I think it was 1926 with the automobile side of things. So for a while, they were operating under the same umbrella, you know, same as, you know, the car maker and the bicycle maker were the same. Not facility maybe exactly, but maybe next door, you know, run by the same group of people. And then in 1926, they separated.
And the era of the bicycle for Peugeot begins under Armand Peugeot,
who we should
mention here, because he is one of the guys who pioneered the automobile aspect of this.
Yeah, and they're doing this. They started building bikes 52 years prior to when they started building automobiles. So
exactly.
It's a long time business for them. They had many different forms of the bike. But let's jump ahead to 1882. Because in 1882, they started making something called the Grand Bi-Penny Farthing.
Yeah.
And this is one of those crazy bikes that has those huge front wheels and the tiny, tiny rear wheel.
Right. And if you're a younger person, you're probably most familiar with this from cutaway sketches on the show The Family Guy.
Probably. Honestly. Yeah, that's right.
And those things, I get how they have such a unique look, but they are neither the safest to operate nor the easiest.
No, that's when they move to, well, they eventually, well, you know what? You can watch videos of the transition of bicycles from that penny farthing look, mm-hmm. Down to where they called it, the safety bicycle, I think,
right.
Finally,
yep.
Where they finally started to change the size of the front wheel, and then they changed the size of the back wheel, and then they made two wheels in the back, and then they made the front just a little bit smaller, and mm-hmm. It just transitions into what becomes the safety bicycle, which has two identical sized wheels, front and back.
Mm-hmm.
And, then a lot of other advancements along the way, being able to have a coaster gear and things like
sure,
that.
Sure, yeah.
Because those penny farthings, you got to keep pedaling. And, I don't know if I even know how somebody gets on top of a penny farthing. It's so high up there. I know there's a trick to it. It's a balancing act.
I think getting on a penny farthing is the origin of parkour, the French martial art that emphasizes agility. No, that's totally not true.
That completely cracks me up. Because I could almost picture somebody having to do a half flip to get up there.
Right.
Or something.
Leaning the bike against the wall and then running up the side of the wall and back flipping onto it. No, there's an art. I am not a practitioner of.
Yeah. Getting on that thing
the
and
art
then
off. Riding a penny farthing.
Well, also the dismount would be very difficult as well. So anyways, we can talk about.
There's got to be a system, you know, there's a way.
Well, we can talk about the up and downsides of the penny farthing, maybe off air. How about
sure,
that?
Yeah.
I think we've already discussed it enough, but it is an important part of Peugeot's history.
Absolutely.
And as is the bicycle, which again, as we said, carried right through to almost to 2015, really.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very close. They continued that manufacturing, but, in the 1880s, they were a very busy group. They began their car manufacturing as well in the 1880s, right?
Yeah. So Armand Peugeot is a pioneer of the automobile industry because he got into it very early. He was always very interested in this. So the first, well, I guess we can say the first car-like thing they built.
How about motorized vehicle?
The first motorized vehicle was actually steam-powered.
Yeah.
It was a tricycle.
Yeah, tricycle. So three-wheeler, which isn't unusual for that day to make what looks like just a big box that, of course, contains all the steam power apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
And a very simple form. It had a rudder steer, I believe. It was built with the help of a steam specialist of that era. The guy's name was Leon Serpollet. Mm-hmm. And, of course, a lot of manufacturers were working on steam cars at the time, and steam mm-hmm. was a popular form of, I guess we'll call it motorization, propulsion.
Right. It was an early competitor to, people already had steam locomotives, right?
Sure.
So it makes sense again to at least attempt to replicate the same technology in a different format, to pull a Taco Bell move.
Sure. Okay. I keep bringing that back. That's good. That's a good
idea. I'm sorry. I'm hungry.
No, I am too. You just got to quit saying it.
I promise. That's the last time I mentioned
it. Before we get out of here.
You know what? If I mention any more, it's going to sound like an advertisement.
Okay. Then we won't again.
Well, all fast food companies do this, I think.
But I am going to think about that right now.
Well, while we're thinking about that, it does make sense, though, to replicate or attempt to replicate an already existing technology. However, that steam emphasis did not last for very long at all.
Yeah, that's right. It was only about a year later when Armand decided that he wanted something a little different. He wanted a petrol-based engine to power his newest vehicle.
Ah, yes, and four wheels. But he didn't call it a car, Scott. Ladies and gentlemen, he called it the Type 2 Quadricycle.
Yeah, Type 2 Quadricycle, which makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was a quadricycle. Henry Ford had a quadricycle.
That
was
a bicycle has two wheels.
Yeah, that's right. The Daimler guys were putting together a quadricycle as well. Mercedes-Benz was doing the same thing. It's mm-hmm. That's what you did. So this this quadricycle that he put together, in fact, had a Daimler engine. He didn't develop his own engine or anything
right.
like that. He used that, but he did build his own vehicle. And this, I guess, would officially be the first four-wheel motorized vehicle that Peugeot ever built. And that was, what, in 1890, I think?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so 1890, that's the very first Peugeot.
Yeah, that's the very first Peugeot motorized vehicle, as we said. And this works pretty well because here's the thing. in terms of technical aptitude or technical quality, it's blowing the competition out of the water.
Yeah.
It's just more sophisticated. It has stuff like a sliding gear transmission, which is not very la-di-da today, of course, but back then was mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, instead of just having one gear, like, or an on-off, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Because along the way, and I think we need to mention this too, is that there were, you know, steam power, electric power, and then,
IC.
Yeah, exactly right. So, there's all three of those, you know, types of propulsion to kind of battling it out at this point, and, you know, who's going to win. And Armand here is betting on, petroleum at this point.
Wow. The Chiefs did it. They went back to back.
The end of another season, and now for some time away from the studio.
Oh, Mark, we're not done. Now the fun starts. It's the offseason.
The combine.
Guys running really fast. You bet we're covering
it. Free agency.
Old faces and new places. Of course we'll talk about it.
Got the draft.
The next generation of stars. It's a must.
I'll just set up a sleeping bag in the studio.
That's right. There's no better way to stay up to date on the latest from our league than listening to Around the NFL. We'll break down all the moves in free agency and make sure you're ready for the start of next season.
I'll be here, so you should listen to every word we say about everything we see.
That's right, Mark.
Listen to the Around the NFL podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Heed the call.
It's draft season. The 2024 NFL Draft is coming up, and the Move the Sticks podcast has you covered for all your draft needs. Do you want to watch the game like a fan or have the mind of a scout? The show's hosted by me, Daniel Jeremiah, and my partner, Bucky Brooks. The two of us bring knowledge from careers as NFL talent scouts to the podcast world so fans can watch and understand the nuances of the game like never before.
If you want to learn everything about this year's prospects ahead of the draft and learn what makes them stand out, there's no better podcast than Move the Sticks. Who are the top five draft prospects at each position? Which quarterbacks are going in the first round? Who are the top 50 prospects in the draft? Who should you put in your mock draft? We have all the answers for you.
We've been studying these prospects all season, so you won't get a better opinion. We'll have several new episodes dropping each week, and you don't want to miss a single one. Subscribe now and listen to the Move the Sticks podcast on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
Came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Right. And this is a gamble that pays off, but it's a gamble that a lot of other early motorized vehicle companies, let's call them, were making the wrong bets on.
Sure.
You know, there were a lot of companies that lost out because they focused on electric vehicles.
Yeah, exactly. So in 1891, though, I mean, here's how well this is doing for him. And this is going to be two first claims, which I don't really like to read on air because it's difficult to prove these or disprove these. And,
right.
And there's always some argument back and forth, but
you always have to qualify.
All right.
Them.
So these two first claims are coming from a site from, from a Peugeot site, in the UK. But, the series produced Type 3 is rolled out in 1891. Now this is, the Type 3 is the first series manufactured car in the world, according to Peugeot. So, there's always those little qualifiers that are stuck on there. So let me read that again. It's the Type 3 is the first series manufactured car in the world, and there were 64 examples of these built. And in fact, in January, and this is 2 years later, in January of 1893, the Peugeot Type 3 is the very first car to ever be driven in Italy. Ever. The very first car in Italy was a French car. What do you think they think about that?
Ooh, I bet a lot of people argue just as a point of pride.
Fighting words, right?
Those are fighting words.
Those are fighting words, yeah. So let's move on to 1896. How about that?
Ah, yes.
All right.
1896. Big year, right?
Yeah. Well, this is when the traditional and the automobile manufacturing separated. So the things like the bikes and the tooling and all that stuff, that means like the traditional manufacturing that they did, the steelwork type stuff,
mm-hmm.
the tooling and all that, separated officially from the automobile manufacturing in 1896. So it became its own thing at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We should also mention that along the way, Peugeot became, according to their claims, the first manufacturer to fit, solid rubber tires to their vehicles.
Were these the Michelin tires? I believe it was.
I think you're right.
I think Michelin created mm-hmm. those tires. I read something about that. It was just in passing. I don't remember any of the
No, because we did
it.
That episode earlier on Michelin, didn't we?
I think.
Or did they just show up like a cameo?
That's possibly. Yeah, I think. I don't know if we've had a full Michelin episode or not, but we've definitely had some tire episodes.
Yeah, there, so right? we've had to talk about Michelin because they are such an established and also a surprisingly old company.
I feel like we've done a lot of tire shows on this program because it seems like, you know, it seems like a simple thing, but there's so many innovations in the mm-hmm. world of tires that are happening and over the decades, over the century, really, you know, with pneumatic tires and the tube tires and the designs.
Oh, the Rilligans?
Regenerative treading on them. And the tweels and all that uh-huh. stuff. There's just always something happening with tire technology.
Bulletproof self-reinflating tires that the president always rolls on.
Yeah, you know? And the tires that, you know, the Brinks trucks roll on and just there's a lot of stuff. All those, the ones you just mentioned, the balloon tires.
Oh, Rilligans. Yeah,
those are really cool.
Yeah,
those were really weird. And recent. We talked about
so
that
many
recently.
Of the tires we named cost more than my car. Just to lay that out there. Yeah. Anyway, as you were saying, we go back to.
Yeah. So they're separate at this point. So the mm-hmm. bikes and the tooling and all that stuff, what they call traditional manufacturing, is separated from the automobile manufacturing part of the business. So, and the company that Armand Peugeot creates is called Automobiles Peugeot. Very simple.
Very simple.
Yeah. Very simple. And then in 1897, just 1 year later, they build their first official automotive plant dedicated to automotive production for Peugeot automobiles.
And during this time, that was 97, right?
1897.
So during this time, semi-concurrent, they also enter into racing. And we'll just occasionally pepper in this. I don't want to spend too much time on it. But in 1894, just a few years earlier, a guy named Albert Lemaitre becomes the first petrol-powered finisher in a competitive motoring event, and he does it with a Peugeot Type 7 from Paris to Rhone, going the life-threatening speed of 12 miles an hour.
So this is one of those long-distance races, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I like those a bit, but you're right, life-threatening speed of 12 miles per hour. That's it wasn't unheard of, but think about the road system at the time, too.
Exactly. That's a really good point.
Yeah, so that's probably why it was so slow. And not only that, I mean, of course, the cars aren't that fast either.
3.7 horsepower.
Well, it's a big mix of everything, right? Mm-hmm. And you know what? The history, the racing history of this this mark,
wow, the Chiefs did it. They went back-to-back.
The end of another season, and now for some time away from the studio.
Oh, Mark, we're not done. Now the fun starts. It's the off-season.
The combine.
Guys running really fast. You bet we're covering
it. Free agency.
Old faces and new places. Of course we'll talk about it.
The draft.
The next generation of stars. It's a must.
I'll just set up a sleeping bag in the studio.
That's right. There's no better way to stay up to date on the latest from our league than listening to Around the NFL. We'll break down all the moves in free agency and make sure you're ready for the start of next season.
I'll be here, so you should listen to every word we say about everything we see.
That's right, Mark.
Listen to the Around the NFL podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Heed the call.
It's draft season. The 2024 NFL Draft is coming up, and the Move the Sticks podcast has you covered for all your draft needs. Do you want to watch the game like a fan or have the mind of a scout? The show's hosted by me, Daniel Jeremiah, and my partner, Bucky Brooks. The two of us bring knowledge from careers as NFL talent scouts to the podcast world so fans can watch and understand the nuances of the game like never before.
If you want to learn everything about this year's prospects ahead of the draft and learn what makes them stand out, there's no better podcast than Move the Sticks. Who are the top five draft prospects at each position? Which quarterbacks are going in the first round? Who are the top 50 prospects in the draft? Who should you put in your mock draft? We have all the answers for you.
We've been studying these prospects all season, so you won't get a better opinion. We'll have several new episodes dropping each week, and you don't want to miss a single one. Subscribe now and listen to the Move the Sticks podcast on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It goes way, way back. I mean, the very beginning of the Grand Prix era.
Right, right, exactly.
Into Formula One. It goes and later into endurance racing and rally racing. And they've got all kinds of awards, and they've won championships in lots of different series. Mm. Can I mention just a couple while we're talking about
sure,
it?
Sure, sure. But as set up for this, I think you will appreciate this, listeners, and you'll enjoy this too, Scott. I said that Albert was the first to finish in that Type 7, the first petrol power car to finish.
Yeah.
He finished second, 3 minutes behind a steam-powered tractor.
Oh, no kidding. Wait, a steam-powered tractor?
Yes. Just to let everyone know, because nowadays I think it's so easy for us to forget that steam-powered vehicles were really a viable alternative at the time, or they seemed to be.
Yeah, they were nearly perfected at that time, you know, because this is late in steam technology, I guess, in a way. But very, very early on in IC technology, so... interesting to see how the two matched up early on like that. You know, the steam powered tractor, beats out the IC powered vehicle, the actual car
by 3 minutes.
By 3 minutes, that's not too bad, I guess. If it's a long distance race, you know, that's pretty close, really. Mm-hmm. Especially in these early days that we're talking about.
That means they could see each other probably.
You're right. 3 minutes, that could be a distance of 100 yards.
Right. Yeah.
That's funny to think about. So I'm going to mention just a couple of quick, you know, championships and victories and things. These go into the modern day, but it'll give you an idea that, you know, this is a powerhouse in motorsport, really. This is by no means a complete list either, but they have an impressive history that goes back, of course, more than a century, as we've talked about. They've won the World Rally Championship 5 times. They've also won the Intercontinental Le Mans Cup twice in 2010 and 2011. They won the World Endurance Championship twice, back in 92 and 93. They won the Intercontinental Rally Challenge Championship 3 times. And just very recently, in 2013, the Peugeot Sport passed the record that was set on the ascent of Pikes Peak. So, you know, remember when Sebastian Loeb drove up Pikes Peak just in late 2013 or mid-2013?
Right. We mentioned it on the air.
Oh, yeah, we did, because a record run? It was a record run of just 8 minutes, 13.878 seconds all the way to the top. That's an 875 horsepower mid-engined, Peugeot 208 T16, I think, that he was driving. So it's a very powerful, obviously purpose-built vehicle, but
right.
Again, they're still breaking records. They've got, a triple victory of the Peugeot 208 GTI in its class at the 24 hours of Nürburgring. Mm-hmm. Let's see, just one more here. In 2015, Peugeot also returned to the Dakar Rally after they had 4 victories in the 1980s. And I don't think they did all that well in 2015, but they're coming back in 2016. So, you know, there's more stuff on the horizon for the Peugeot brand, and they've always been this, as I said before, a motorsport powerhouse, really.
Mm-hmm.
So right. Let's get back to the 1800s, I guess.
Okay. I want to say something that a lot of people might not know. We think of the pre-industrial revolution and the industrial revolution itself often as a time of squalor and hardship and, child labor, right? Mm-hmm. People sleeping on the floors in piles of soot or something, eating charcoal. I don't know. I'm exaggerating a little. Yeah. Well, it turns out that the Peugeot family was actually driven by their religious convictions. They were intensely concerned with the well-being of their employees. And in many ways, I don't mean to throw any stones here, in many ways, this was anomalous for the time. So they instituted things like a 10-hour working day, a mutual assistance society for their employees that, you know, they bankrolled if something bad happened to someone, work injury or something. They subsidized housing. They gave them pensions for widows and retired workers. And at the time, that kind of stuff is unusual, man.
Oh, really unusual. For the turn of the century, that would be the turn of the 20th century, right?
Even before then.
Very, very unusual. And, I mean, look back to, you know, some of the labor laws and stuff that didn't come about for another few decades, even here in the States or elsewhere in the world. So, and that was all to protect against stuff like that, the opposite of that happening, I suppose, you know, mm-hmm. like we're working 15 or 16 hour days or even 18 hour days.
You have to ask yourself, too, if you're designing products that require precision, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The bicycle axles have to be relatively aligned, right?
Pretty straight.
Yeah. And this just becomes even more complex by an order of magnitude when you're talking about building a car.
Yeah, sure. They're making things like, springs for watchmaking and stuff like that. It's mm-hmm. Precision work in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It wasn't done quite as automatically as it is now. I mean, it was a lot of hand labor that had to happen there, a lot of skill.
Yeah, and where are we in the timeline there?
I think we're right around the turn of the century. So,
great.
What have you got, Ben? I'm
shaking my finger, guys, and Scott's looking at me because shaking my finger and shaking my head as though I'm about to say something, but I'm stopping myself. And all I will say is that they took a pre-existing thing and sold it a different way.
Ah, so this may be the, okay.
This might be a secret to success, my friend.
It just might be. I know the theory you're talking about. Let's just put it that way.
Right. So
1903, they're building motorcycles, but they're probably based on their bicycles. And you can all picture the type of motorcycles that they're building. The ones that look like the old the board track racers.
Mm-hmm. That's a good call.
Very cool motorcycles.
They're also producing around half of the cars built in France at this time.
Oh my gosh.
They're gigantic.
Production has really taken off at this point. So let's jump back into the timeline here in, about 1905?
Yeah, 1905, 1906, something funny happens. There are cars that are sold as Lion Peugeots.
Lion Peugeot. So this is like a different brand name, right?
Right, but it's still a Peugeot, which can be confusing to people.
Well, the idea was they would produce a different range of the same type of automobile, is that right? A different type,
essentially. So here's what happens. If we go back, there is a disagreement between some of the cousins who inherit the ownership of Peugeot.
Oh, here we go.
It always happens, man. Tale as old as time. Okay, because there's this cousin, Eugene Peugeot, who is also involved in the company way back before 1905, when it's still just making bicycles.
Okay.
And Eugene opposes the amount of money they have to spend to start making cars. And so they split away.
So this battle is like decades old at this point.
Right. So this is, this is where we're talking about that split between the solely bicycle manufacturing arm of the company. So they signed this agreement that gave Armand's business the exclusive right to make the Peugeot automobiles. And the agreement then was that the biking part of it would stay out of these powered vehicles at all. So they continued to produce, but the bicycle guys didn't really follow this agreement because they kept producing bicycles, tricycles, and quadricycles, some of which were powered and other ones which weren't. And so they had this sort of cold war.
Well, wait a minute. So the bicycle manufacturer is producing a quadricycle that's powered.
I know.
And they're calling that a bicycle. They're saying that falls under the bicycle umbrella.
I mean, obviously, these guys are not cool with each other at this point, Scott. But by 1905, control over that sort of nominally bicycle part of Peugeot passes down to Eugene's three sons, Robert, Pierre, and Jules. And so these folks are not near as angry with Armand, who controls the automobile stuff.
Sure, they're distant. They're far removed from it at this point.
Right. So they have a detente, you know, and they take care of their Cold War. And that's when the bicycle company, Eugene's company, and that his sons are running now, they agree to pay $1 million every year to Armand. And if they do that, Armand says, I will let you manufacture cars outside of my automobile Peugeot.
Oh, okay.
And that is where they start selling the Lion Peugeots.
Oh, got it. Okay. Wow. Very, very well done, Ben.
I hope we got it right, man. That's a maze.
It really was. And, you know, I didn't get any of that out of my bad translation over here that I'm looking at. So, I appreciate you clearing that up for me.
Oh, well,
in the timeline. There's a big hole in this timeline for me, but, let's jump ahead to, the late 1920s. How about that? 1929.
Oh, this is a big one.
And I know we've jumped far ahead. There's a lot of stuff that happened along the way, but we can't hit every single year. So, 1929, this is a big one. This is Peugeot's first mass-produced car, the 201 model.
Ah, yes.
And not only that, this is the first Peugeot to use the now iconic numbering system with the O in the middle, you know, the number designation, mm-hmm. With three numbers. There's a reason that is the way it is, and we can talk about that either now or later, whichever you choose. But
well, let's talk about it now.
Well, I guess we wanted to say one more quick thing about the 201 is that in 29, this, again, first mass-produced car, it kind of moves them from Even to this point, they're still considered a small business.
Mm-hmm.
But when they start mass producing this car in the late 20s, they become a big business. This is a mass produced vehicle for the world, really.
Right.
At this point. So it's a big deal to them. And this numbering convention, which I'll tell you about in just a moment, carries over for the next few, you know, makes of cars that they make, or models of cars that they make, rather. The 301 launches in 1932, the 401, and then the 601 launch in 1934. And then today, there's even modern descendants of that line of vehicles, which you will kind of understand it when I read it to you. It's going to be a little difficult to grasp, but maybe you need to see it for yourself to understand. But today, the descendants of that original 201 are the 208, the 308, and the 508 in the modern day era.
Yeah, they're still extant. Yeah,
yeah, kind of strange to think of it that way, but this whole naming convention thing is something that the company apparently takes great pride in. I mean, in the history and the way that they do it, and it's not quite as simple.
Not engine based.
It's a little difficult. And there's a couple of changes along the way and some exceptions that we'll also read, but let's see. I guess maybe we'll talk about what it is first of all. There's the single O that's in the center of each designation, each vehicle designation, model designation. And you do pronounce it O. It's not 208. It's 208.
Uh-huh.
That's how you would say it. And the three digit identity is essential in the brand identity for each vehicle, I guess. And it hasn't changed since the launch of the 201 back in 1929, which had the very first O designation. And there are three, bits of information that are associated with that number every time you see that number. The first is that the first number indicates the family to which the vehicle belongs, like in its size or in its range.
Uh-huh.
And then the second digit, which is always zero, although there's going to be a couple of exceptions.
Right.
It's always zero. And that's the link, the number that, I guess links this, the family of the vehicle with the third number, which is the generation of the model.
Right.
So, you have to kind of read this and really think about it and look at it to understand exactly, you know, along with their product line, maybe to understand exactly where they're going with it. But,
there's a fun fact too about that O, right?
What's that?
Well, in the early things, like in the very first, you know, 208 or whatever, the O on the front grille was where the crankshaft was inserted to start the engine.
Oh, no kidding. Cleverly disguised.
Cleverly. Class.
Oh, well, that is pretty classy. That's kind of cool. All right, so here's some of the changes that have happened. I think there was a change in 2004 where Peugeot decided to expand its naming system by doubling the central zero, or the central O again.
Right.
And this will bring about a problem that I'll talk about at the end of this in just a moment, but kind of a funny problem, really. So so after 2004, some of the larger SUV and family cars within the Peugeot range now have 4 digits instead of 3 digits. Just, you know, adding that double zero, I guess. Minor change, but it's kind of a big deal to them, right? And in 2012, there was another change where they announced that the third number representing the generation of the model would remain with the number 8. Now, that's a weird thing to do,
it's
right?
Just going to stay at 8.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. It's so the first new Peugeot model to retain the same name is the all-new Peugeot 308. Rather than being launched as the Peugeot 309, they kept it as the 308. It's all very confusing, isn't it? It gets complex when you think about it in the way that they've,
sure,
they've made alterations to this whole thing along the way. So, you know, earlier I mentioned the double O thing, right?
Yes. So, yeah. Oh, this is hilarious.
Okay. So here's the reason. And, you know, the larger SUVs and family cars get this double O designation, but this is the exception. This is one you would read instead of saying, like 2008, you would say 2008. And the reason is because the producers of the Bond franchise?
Yeah. The folks who own the James Bond franchise said you can't, essentially they said you can't double O. Double O is our thing.
Yeah, so like, they had a model that launched in, I think it was in 2004, that was launched with the name 1007.
Right, and keep in mind, this is before they changed that only 8 rule.
Yeah, so instead of reading it as 1007, which is the way that Peugeot now has to do that with the double O for these models, you would say the 1007, and the Bond guy said, no, you're not doing that.
And you have to wonder what happened behind the scenes, right? Was there something, was there like an Aston Martin lawyer?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, it seems like you wouldn't really confuse a Peugeot, you know, minivan or something with, or an SUV of some kind with, with being associated with the Bond franchise. But I guess there's something to that.
I mean, yeah, not for nothing. No, they do say 007 in every single James Bond film.
Well, that's true. That's true. And then, you know, there's another exception here, and that would be the letters only exception, which is really weird for them because they usually use numbers only, but there's a letters only exception, and then there's a letters and numbers exception too. So there's an iconic car that they have out right now called the RCZ. And we can talk about the RCZ if we want later or some other time, but it's a pretty cool looking car. They just stopped building it. It's one that we've never seen here in the United States on the roads, but, fascinating vehicle anyways. There's a lot to look into there. But it's the first specialist Peugeot car not to utilize the numbering system, with the central or double zero, designating the brand and the model and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah.
The generation and all that. So, the RCZ is kind of breaking from that mold, but then there's another one where letters and numbers are employed, and this is the last thing I promise, guys, because I know it's getting a little dry with the designations, but it's important to this company.
No, this is also something that once you know what's going on, you can't unsee it.
That's true. It's kind of like the BMW numbering system or something like that, where the numbers mean something. It's just you have to figure out what that code is.
Only the initiated know.
Yeah, so this is all part of the Peugeot code, I guess, and the reason why numbers and letters are used on some vehicles or on just a couple of vehicles is that within the Peugeot car range, each family of cars can include different body styles. So those are designated by the same 3-digit number with special symbols added when required. So like for the example of the coupe cabriolet body style, which is a coupe and then a convertible as well, right? Which is designated by the letters CC. So you get like a 308 CC. And then there's a wagon body style, which is identified by touring. So it'd be like 308 touring. It makes sense when you see how they do it and you understand, you know, the role that each number in that nameplate designates. So, you know, again, the family or the range of vehicles, the linking O or double O, and then finally the generation of the model at the end.
Right. And if we look at the timeline, these naming conventions continue through 2 world wars. We should also mention that.
Yeah, yeah.
Peugeot is one of the companies that managed to survive incredible industrial pressure of World Wars I and II.
Not to mention bombings and all that was happening in their region. But during the First World War, we should mention that Peugeot turned to arms production, as did a lot of manufacturing facilities at that time. They became a major manufacturer of military vehicles, including bicycles, tanks, shells, of course. You know, they produced just about anything they could out of metal. They were a fabricating facility. So that's World War I production. And then World War II, this is a little bit tougher for them because they were still producing vehicles as the Nazis occupied France.
Right.
In the early 1940s, late 1930s. they were still building the 402, which is a 2.1 liter production vehicle that they were building, I think, from 1935 until about 1941.
Mm-hmm.
And then regular production, I guess, you know, kind of went away at that point for obvious reasons. I mean,
sure.
It's a war-torn region. And regular production then begins again around
46.
Yeah, mid-1946, and then it goes until about 1949, I think, right?
All right. Scott, stop me if I'm going too far in the timeline, okay? But here's an interesting thing. Peugeot in 1953 launches scooters.
Yes. So they're, again, developing new products all the time. And in 1953, this is just after, well, not long after, but not long after World War II, they're
right.
Developing scooters. And we had a whole scooter podcast, didn't
mm-hmm.
we, that talked about why that whole region was really big into scooter production and mopeds and all that.
Yeah.
It's a simple form of transportation, cheap, easy to get around these just absolutely decimated roadways.
Right.
That you know, had been bombed just beyond belief and across, you know, even just to get it around in the factories.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an economical, smart form of transportation at the time, and everybody could have one.
I still wonder why this didn't occur to the company earlier.
Oh.
You know, if you already have the bikes, you know, they were doing something like it. I guess a scooter is just a different design, you know. So they are the oldest manufacturer of motorized two-wheel vehicles in the world, right?
Well, another claim, but I don't know. I'm not sure.
Another claim, but yeah. I maybe the oldest continuing manufacturer.
Yeah.
You know, Scott, if you add enough caveats to anything, everyone's got a world record.
No, sure. Yeah, you're exactly right.
But, so they've been responsible for a lot of innovations in the world of scootering.
Yep. And then in 1962, there was a very classic design, one that a lot of collectors really covet, I guess. It would be the iconic 404 Cabriolet design, which was designed by Pininfarina. And it is a beautiful little convertible car here. The picture I'm looking at is a red convertible, of course. Looks really, really nice. But Peugeot has a history of building a lot of stylish coupes and cabriolets. And so that 404 Cabriolet is kind of like the forerunner of today's convertible designs that you'll see mm-hmm. on the showroom floor. And, you know, let's jump ahead a little bit here in the timeline. Let's go up to 1974.
Ooh.
And we're going to kind of pick up some steam here. Let's move on a little faster on this timeline. How about
okay,
that? I think
yeah.
we're running out of time.
So Peugeot buys a huge share of Citroën.
Yeah, 1974, 1975, so right around that era, Citroën is in financial trouble, and we've discussed the whole Citroën situation. Remember?
Right, yeah.
And they just had too many new models at the time. They had just not enough financial resources to make it all work. They had some great product.
Oh, yeah.
It's just that they just couldn't keep it all together without, you know, just forking over way too much money at the time. So to bail them out, Peugeot bought them at that
point.
In
75.
In 1975. And then in 1978, still gaining speed, they take over Chrysler Europe. Now, Chrysler Europe was, I guess, formerly Simca and Roots.
Yeah.
And
sold as Talbots.
Yeah, that's right. They continued production of those vehicles. The Talbot badge is something that we haven't seen in a long time. You'll see Talbots at, you know, Concours events here in the United States or, you know, in museums and things, but we're just not familiar with that. But you might be surprised to hear that, Talbot branded passenger cars were, produced all the way up until about 1987.
I know, it's crazy.
It really is. And then commercial vehicles even longer up until about 1992. It's just,
neither of which look as good as the classic Talbots.
No. In our market here in the United States, in the North American market, we just don't see those Talbot-branded passenger cars
right.
ever.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a point of fascination with us. Okay, so now we're up to, about 1977?
Yeah.
And
yeah, 1977.
77. Now, remember, they've been building bicycles since 1882,
mm-hmm.
and it's been a big part of the Peugeot story all along. But in 1977, Peugeot, you know, the brand of bicycle, I guess, won its 10th Tour de France. And it's a record number of victories that, and I don't know about this claim, Ben, but it's a record that has been unbeaten until today.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't dug into the manufacturer of the bicycles of the Tour de France, you know, at least in the last 3 years. You know, I do that normally every year because I like to keep up on
right.
all this stuff.
Right. You just like to keep tabs.
I'm like that. I do that
yeah.
with bicycle. No, I'm just kidding. I don't do any of that. I've never looked that information up, but, supposedly that is a record number of victories that is apparently unbeaten until today.
Peugeot bikes have pushed multiple people to first place in Tour de France.
I like how you said that. That's almost like a, that's like a slogan, Ben. They could use that as a magazine title.
Well, you know what? We'll see. I'm not going to say no.
Something catchy about it. I don't know.
It's an honor to be nominated.
Yeah.
So on the way, they're still active, of course, in the late 70s, mm-hmm. and they build winning bikes.
Yeah, build winning bikes, that's right. And let's see what else they're doing. They're also building some pretty great passenger cars.
Yeah.
There's a model that comes out in around 1983, and it's a record-breaking model for the Peugeot brand. It's the 205.
The Super Mini.
Yeah, that's right. And then later in 1984, there's a 205 GTI. There's also a turbo version. Rally cars, all that goes along with this in the mid 1980s. It's just becomes one of those cars that you see everywhere. There's a mm-hmm. lot of these produced too. Like 6.5 million of these cars have been produced.
The Honda Civic, in some ways.
Yeah, exactly right. That's kind of what it is. And pushing further into the 1990s, I guess, the environmental concerns become kind of a big thing with them, right?
Yes.
And well, this is also, I guess, since we're at this point, we should tell them this is where they stopped bringing these cars to the North American market.
Yeah, this is the beginning of the death knell or suspension of Peugeot in the U.S. because Peugeot is, and what I'm saying U.S. market is kind of a misnomer. What we should say is Canada, U.S., and Mexico, yeah. but U.S. could have been a really big market. Unfortunately, Peugeot was just having problems competing and having problems hitting some of those regulatory standards.
Yeah, it was a difficult market to be in the late 1980s, and I know we're running late here, so let's keep moving on. But the late 1980s, it was a tough market to be in. The sales weren't all that great. They were competing with the Japanese automakers here in the United States, and of course the domestic makers as mm-hmm. well. And what was happening was, in order to move product, they had to drastically cut the price of the cars that were on the lot.
Right.
And again, where they're positioned, they're positioned kind of in the middle here. They're not the high end, they're not the low end, but they're in the middle. And for them to cut to price it as a lower end vehicle, that was difficult for them to make any money.
Right.
And sales were dropping. It was just kind of uncompetitive with the other models that were there as well. So there's a combination of all this stuff happening, and total sales fell to something like just over 4,000 units in 1990, and then it went even lower. I guess, this is not really fair to say this though, because they only sold them for about half the year in 1991, but they only sold something like 2,240 cars in 1991 up until about July. And that's when they ceased U.S. and Canada operations. And that's after what, 33 years of importing these cars?
Right.
And at that point, they didn't really have any plans to return to the U.S. market either.
Ah, but wait.
This might be the last piece of the puzzle, Ben, really. I mean, there's probably more that we could cover, but mm-hmm. let's leave it at this.
Last piece for today.
Yeah, there's a chance that Peugeot will come back to the United States. That's good news for us, because it's just something we don't see very often.
And it's also, forgive me for being skeptical, it's a chance. I'm optimistic.
Yeah.
Or what's the old Reagan thing? I trust but verify.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And this was reported by Edmunds back in 2014, so early 2014. They were thinking that there's a chance that the Peugeot brand name will return to U.S. showrooms. And the reason is they're kind of making a big change from the top down over there. And here's the way it reads. I'll just read this little bit for you here, because it has 4 points that I want to bring out. The source that Edmunds had said the source reports go even further, reading that it's not only Peugeot that could make it back to the U.S., but also Citroën and the group's posh brand DS, which is kind of like a luxury brand at this point.
It's, right.
The DS used to be the model, but now it's a luxury brand of its own. It's presented as part of new CEO Carlos Tavares' plan to alter PSA, that's Peugeot SA, I guess, so that it will be able to operate anywhere in the world. Now, that's a pretty bold statement. So they can sell cars in any market that they want.
Yeah.
Which is a big deal, because that opens up a lot of doors for them. There are 4 goals that the manufacturer needs to strike before it can be viable stateside. Number 1 is establishing a 3-brand portfolio. Number 2 is shrinking the range from 45 to 26 models.
Mm-hmm.
That's big. Number 3 is encouraging growth around the world. And number 4 is increasing its manufacturing efficiency. And I guess as of the time that this was written in 2014, the only thing that it needed to do really to hit this 2017 to 2018 goal is that they needed to hit that fourth step. They need to make its manufacturing efficiency just a little bit greater. So they're on track to making this happen for you know, a possible comeback of Peugeot and Citroën in the U.S.
And here's the question, which is hypothetical for now, but may not be soon. Would you buy one?
Oh, boy.
Have you seen those 2016s, man?
Yeah, I have. I mean, I really like that. What was the one that I mentioned before? The RCZ, is that right?
Uh-huh.
That is a beautiful car. Really sharp, but they're not making that one anymore. I don't know what the new ones are like, but they've had some amazing concepts along the way. Mm-hmm. And if part of those designs make it into production, yeah, this would be a great car to have.
And while we're on the subject, I want to recommend a really cool YouTube channel that we found. It's called Auto Gifur with an umlaut over the U. This is a series of pretty in-depth reviews of vehicles. And if you enjoy watching auto reviews on YouTube or online, the way of it, I do, then check these guys out.
Yeah, and you know what? You can look at the entire Peugeot line at Peugeot.com if you want mm-hmm. to. There's a lot of vehicles. I've got a couple of pages printed out in front of me here, but I mean, they have hybrids and electric vehicles. They have sedans. They have saloon cars, which mm-hmm. I thought were the same as sedans, but I'm wrong. There's must be a slight variation in that. Station wagons. They have multi-purpose vehicles, crossover utility vehicles, and SUVs. They've got combis, which I think are, it looks like big vans almost. I don't know what a combi is really, Ben. And there's also something called a LAV, L-A-V. And as far as I know, that means light armored vehicle, but I doubt that's what they're building. I'm not sure. But some fantastic cars, actually. And I got to ask you now.
Yeah.
I think I would consider buying, you know, a sedan or maybe even a hatchback or something like that. They're a good looking car and they've got race history. They're proven, you know, performance vehicles in some aspects. Citroën, if that comes back as well, would you consider buying either one of those? Would you buy, hypothetically, one of those two?
I could be swayed. I'm not going to go out and say that they would immediately be my first choice, mm-hmm. but if the price is right, man.
Why not?
Because they are over time, fairly consistent vehicles.
Yeah,
so.
And really, I mean, take a look at some of the current product available from them. They're really beautiful. If they're not in your area, like they're not here for us, mm-hmm. It's something that you've kind of you got blinders on. You don't really know that that's even out there. But now that I'm looking at them, if they offered them here, I mean, it would be a viable choice, I think,
and
for a lot of people too.
Yeah. And while you're looking at stuff online, go ahead and check out our website where you can see the earlier podcast we mentioned about gray market cars, which has some valuable information if you're considering getting any kind of car that is not normally sold in the USA.
Well, sure. And like motor, we've also got one on the scooters and we've also got one on, the Honda story, which is really a motorcycle story as well.
Sure.
There's all kinds of stuff that's related to this whole thing, but, as usual, Ben, we didn't get to all of our notes. I'm still surrounded by a pile of notes. I really am.
Yeah.
Here, I'll rustle a little bit. I'm surrounded by paper. But we never get to everything in these.
No, we don't. I still have, I've taken to keeping my notes on the computer that I carry in when we do this so that I can just pull them up at a moment's notice, because some of the things that we'll think were in this episode, it's going to turn out they weren't, and I need to have them like right there, man, like lightning.
Yeah. You know, I have I have probably a 2-foot stack of paper that sits on my desk, and that's all my notes from previous podcasts.
It's true, guys.
And it's so hard to search through that and find what I need, but you've got the smart way to do it.
Did we ever post a picture of that?
No, we haven't. We have not.
Maybe one day. I don't know. Maybe one day. But
it's kind of embarrassing.
But for now, find us on Facebook and Twitter. Let us know what you think. Where are you at on Peugeot? Do you support it? Would you buy a 2016 model? Take a look at them. I'm interested in people's opinions on this one, Scott, or maybe a Citroën. In the meantime, if you have a suggestion for something you would like us to cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
More on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcasts@HowStuffWorks.com.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.